So we left off in 2 Kings chapter 2, and at the very end of our last class, we discussed the fact that David had just passed away, and we talked about some of his accomplishments. A part of that lesson was Solomon being anointed or being reaffirmed as king. We see that in 2 Chronicles. It's a reaffirmation. He was anointed twice. We see that the throne was temporarily usurped, or was trying to be usurped, by Adonijah, his older brother. And so now we're going to pick up the story again. I told last time around, I felt like the class was a little disjointed just because of the way the story goes back from 1 Kings to Chronicles. But it's good to have that, to see a storyline of how things kind of laid out chronologically. As we move into this section here, this 2 Kings 2, 13 through 27, I asked a question. What did Adonijah want and request Bathsheba to acquire for him?
He requested
Abishag, the Shunammite, to be his wife. Now, who is Abishag again? The nurse or caretaker for David. She was a virgin. She was the one who took care of him when he was older, kept him warm, that sort of thing. I want to pause for a moment because we talked about this before, and this just continues to roll through my head as we deal with Adonijah and some things that we can learn from it today. You know, this idea of maybe nature versus nurture, you know, the idea of you're born a specific way, or your environment or the way you're raised conditioned you to be a certain way. And Adonijah to me is not an interesting case study, but it's sad, really. You know, so Adonijah tried to usurp the throne from David. He was the fourth son. He was the oldest son of David at this point in time. But we also know that there was the covenant made with God and David. And we know that Solomon was to be the one who was going to reign. We see that David early on after the plague that came and people were dying, David talks about building the temple, amassing the materials for the temple, and that Solomon would be the one to build it. Along with that, he'd be reigning. And we also see that he informed the nation of Israel that they needed to help him. Adonijah knows this stuff. Adonijah tries to usurp the throne, and when that fails, and he finds out that he's not going to die, he turns around and makes a petition. And we'll get to Solomon's reaction in a second. It's interesting to me when you look at verse 15. He comes to Bathsheba. Bathsheba asks if he comes peaceably. He says yes, and she tells him, "Okay, well, tell me what you're wanting." And so he says, "You know that the kingdom was mine, and that all of Israel expected me to be king. However, the kingdom has turned about and become my brother's, for it was his from the Lord. And now I'm making one request of you. Do not refuse me." And he said to him, "Speak." Then he said, "Please speak to Solomon the king, for he will not refuse you, that you may give me Abishag the Shunammite as a wife." Just how brazen and unabashed and delusional Adonijah is here. I mean, you're lucky at this point that you still got your head. I mean, the fact that you've tried to usurp the throne, that Solomon hasn't done anything to you yet, and you still feel entitled enough. You still feel confident enough in your position to make such a request of the king's mother, of your brother, after what you've done. You know, this goes back to the 1 Kings 1:6, where it talks about his father never crossed him at any time by saying, "Why have you done so?" You know, Grandpa mentioned that Adonijah was a spoiled brat. He is entitled. Entitlement being believing one to be inherently deserving of privileges or special treatment. Was he born that way? Or was he conditioned to be that way? That's a question for y'all.
He wasn't used to getting his own way. So then it became a cast pity on me. I didn't get what was supposed to be mine. And so now, let me have this as a feel sorry for me gift.
I don't even know if it's feel sorry for me. Well, I at least deserve.
Yeah.
I mean, and so it's whether it's take pity on me in the way that he's asking, or I deserve at least something but the question again is, was he born this way?
No.
Or is he conditioned to be this way? He's conditioned to be this way. His father had never told him no. It never raised his voice to him, never done any of those things. And that's just, it's a conditioning. It's sad, but we see it in today's time. And y'all may remember this story. I think it was from 2013. I looked up just the date on it. But there's a word called affluenza. Have y'all heard that word before? Y'all may or may not. It's a mixture of affluence and the flu or influenza. Okay, and they call it a psychological disorder. All right, and so affluenza is a social condition that presents itself in privileged individuals who believe that they will not be held accountable for their actions because of their social position. Individuals who suffer from affluenza fail to recognize their social repercussions of their actions, which may cause mental or physical harm or anguish upon others. They usually have trouble functioning in everyday society and distinguishing between right and wrong because the world of privilege that they live in insulates them from the rest of the world. I will say this, that's a cop out. They know what they're doing. They want to say it makes it difficult to live in the world. No, you just turned a blind eye to it. I don't agree with that part of the definition. I bring this up because there was a young man, 17, 18, something like that, back in 2013, who killed some people in a driving accident. I can't remember if it was even drunk driving or not. He killed some people, and he didn't think he should go to jail for it. He didn't really think that there was anything wrong with it. And he didn't understand because of his affluence. And what really brought the affluenza part of it out was they it was either house arrest or he was supposed to go on probation or something until he was out on bond, and he fled. I didn't understand. I just don't get it. And they said, well, because of his wealth, he didn't understand the laws and rules applied to him. Ridiculous. I mean, no, I don't care if you're rich, you're poor. I don't care if what kind of status or power you've got. You're susceptible to the law. You're under the law just like everybody else is. And that was the argument they made. He is not socially conditioned to understand because he is so affluent or he didn't understand the rights and wrongs of it all. Ridiculous. But what do we look at Adonijah? He's completely conditioned to think that he is deserving. He's entitled. He's above the law to a certain extent. I mean, to even be abashed like this, to ask for Abishag, I mean, why he didn't flee, I don't know. I mean, you can see the writing on the wall. At least it seems to me I can. Solomon is more patient, maybe would be the word. I mean, to for a period of time not to have done anything to him. But this idea that, you just don't understand, you know, and the repercussions of your actions because of your affluence is crazy. It goes on to say here that this phenomenon fosters a sense of entitlement that can be self-perpetuating. The wealthy feel that they have earned their way into a social class with superior intellect and talent. As a result, they believe the rules of society that apply to other people do not apply to them. Adonijah. We are all under the law. If Adonijah had paid any sort of attention, he'd have seen what happened to Saul. He'd have seen what happened to David. He will, you know, I mean, you think about it from the standpoint of being under the law and doing what God would have you to do, to abide by his will, to abide by the covenants that he had established. He would see that Saul did not survive what he had done by being dishonest, to not being loyal to God, to following his instructions. You see David, the punishments he received for going outside of God's law. And, yeah, to me, that's a cop-out. And it's sad to say today that we have a terminology for this type of social disorder when it boils down to the idea of disciplining your kids, teaching them right from wrong, teaching them what the law is and how to obey it. And that may be the rules of your house. That may be the rules of the state. That may be the rules that God has instilled for us. You know, and it's so sad. And so I just want to bring that back out because I think you can see the frustration of Solomon when it comes through. Like, how unabashed is it that he's going to ask these things? And where did he get the gall? I guess that's kind of where this came from. Where does he get the gall after doing these things to go and still make a request to the king and think that it's going to be honored? And so I just wanted to bring that to your attention. For us, it's something we should learn that, you know, you'll see it generation to generation. And I think my generation on down, you're seeing it worse and worse. And I think you're starting to see a divide where you have some families who are doing it and some aren't. But you see through generations, well, mom and dad had it hard. And so mom and dad are like, well, I don't want my kids to have it that way. my parents were tough on me, or things were bad, and so I'm going to make a better life for my kids. And so whereas mom and dad were hard on me and they made me work, and I'm not saying that there weren't times when you come through, you think about the generations that came through the Great Depression and the two world wars and how difficult it was, and you wanting a better life for your kids, I understand that. But a better life doesn't equate to no discipline and giving them everything they want, because the generations that went through those things were a great generation for a reason. You know, and then that continues to roll through and roll through. Well, I don't want them to have as tough of a time as I did. And so I'm going to make it easier on them. And easier means I'm going to provide them more and give them more, as opposed to earning it or teaching them understanding of contentment. And then it's not discipline them, because I don't want to be the bad guy, which is another mentality from the standpoint of, I don't spend time with my kids because I'm too worried about, you know, getting more and more and amassing more and wealth. And you know, instead, again, contentment, which a part of this is this idea of, I need to have more and more, I need to gain more and more to hit that next social plateau, that next tax bracket or whatever. And you're seeing that now, where you can't get kids to work. You got these 35, 40 year old sons and daughters who are still living at home, who parents won't kick them out, who won't tell them no. And people, this isn't just, you know, in the world, that's in Christian homes. I know so many people right now, parents who have kids who are in their mid to late 20s. No job. Christian homes. Living at home. Being provided by their parents. They're an adult. You don't run their lives anymore. And whether your social arrangement is what it is, I mean, I'm it's a generalization. I went back and lived with mom and dad after I got a job and so I could get on my feet. But I'm talking about, they're not a kid anymore. They're responsible for their own actions. You shouldn't be setting a curfew for them. You should make sure that they're abiding by the rules of the law. They're adults. Get them out of the house. I mean, just stop babying them. And that's the kind of the culture we're hitting into today. And if you can't tell, it's a hot button topic for me, because if you're in the workforce, and I'm sure Wayne probably sees this a little bit in the standpoint of, you get these new hires in, or you get these younger generations in, and they expect to make top dollar for never having done anything. They feel like they're entitled to it. They come in with an attitude of doing the bare minimum. They're not going to work hard. No performance-based raises. It's, I deserve this because I got the degree. And I know good young men who have graduated college who are being taught that in college, that you deserve this amount of money. No, you earn to get to that point. You don't graduate and go to making what, you know, somebody who's been in the business for 40 years makes. And so the generation and mindset now, your work ethic went from a higher standard to now what is considered a high standard is what was mediocre 20, 30 years ago. And people are scrambling for those people, because we're scraping the bottom of the barrel just to get people in the door now, because people don't want to work. And so, anyway, we'll move on. I'm getting off my soapbox. All that to say, okay, so Adonijah makes this request. What's Solomon's response?
Why don't you just ask for the kingdom?
Exactly. Why don't you just ask for the kingdom? How would you describe, Sandra, that's the way he... Well, why do you think he responds that way? Because I think this is open for interpretation. But why do you think Solomon responds that way?
Because of the fact that Abishai has helped David. In that day's time, I read that, you don't do that. When he was asking for Abishai, he was thinking, maybe it's another way of getting the kingdom back.
I agree. I think that is a part of that decision to ask for Abishag is, oh, well, she had a status with my dad, and there may be status or power that comes with being with the nurse who nursed the king, this great king, back to, while he was elderly, kind of gets him a foothold in. Anybody else has an explanation as to why Solomon responded that way? I agree. I mean, that's another way to just to try to tear down his kingdom, to put a slide against his kingdom. What I find interesting in that, reading this 3 and 4 times, something else stuck out to me. King Solomon answered his mother. So she's requesting, let Abishag the Shunammite be given to Adonijah, your brother's wife. And King Solomon answered and said to his mother, and why are you asking for Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask for him the kingdom. It's not just a condemnation on Adonijah. Like, mom, why in the world are you coming to me from, you know, with this usurper's request? Why don't you just give him the kingdom? If you're going to ask for this, why don't you just give him the kingdom? How dare he ask for anything? I mean, to me, it's also pointed in a barb at Bathsheba. Why in the world would you come to me and ask for that? And you're perpetuating the system. He feels like he should be able to come to you and ask. And now you're bringing this to me. He should be lucky he's alive. So it's not just the gall of Adonijah, but the fact that Bathsheba would even bring this to him. You know, the way he responds in that way. Well, ask for him the kingdom also, for he is my older brother, even for him and for Abathar the priest and Joab the son of Zerah. You know, no. All right, we're going to stop this now. And so what happens to Adonijah? What'd you say? Death. All right. We're going to put him to death. That's it. We're going to stop this right now. Then King Solomon swore by the Lord, saying, "May God do so to me and more also, if Adonijah has not spoken the word against his own life. Now, therefore, as the Lord lives, who has established me and set me on the throne of David, my father, and who has made my house up as he promised, surely Adonijah shall be put to death today." Was this revenge? Was this sanctioned by God? Sanctioned by God. Looking at the entire picture now, tell me that Adonijah didn't know what he was doing when he tried to usurp the throne. Because that was one of the things as I'm studying this, is did he know, or was, did he just think he was entitled to the throne next, or did he know that he was usurping the throne? In the sense of I'm just the next in line, I'm going to take the throne, versus I know Solomon's going to try to take it because he's promised to him, but I'm the next in line and nobody's ever told me no. I think he knew what he was doing the entire time. How else do you describe the way that Solomon is able to justly put him to death? He's going against God's will. That's Adonijah. All right, so as we talk about Adonijah and what happens to him, then to Abathar. So now he's going to start dealing with those people who followed Abishag, followed Adonijah. So what happened to Abathar? No longer a priest. Why wasn't he killed?
Mm-hmm. Those kind of things. So because of his past service to the king and the Lord.
Yes. Verse 26, "You were afflicted in everything in which my father was afflicted. You carried the ark, so I'm just going to dismiss you." And so Solomon dismissed Abathar from the priest to the Lord. And so Solomon dismissed Abathar from being a priest to the Lord in order to fulfill the word of the Lord, which was had been spoken concerning the house of Eli and Shiloh.
Not only was he dismissed from being a priest, but I understood that he was also banished from the work in his own field.
I think that's right.
And he was at that point where he served with David. Mm-hmm. He probably had servants. So that was another punishment. You have to work in your own field. You can't have servants working for you. You're doing this all yourself.
I mean, he was definitely taken down a notch. I remember reading something about that, and I have to go back and read it again. If that were the case, where either he worked with his servants or he worked it himself, I mean, think about how that fall kind of from grace, you know, fall from, I'm coming all the way down here because of what happened. Now, it's interesting in verse 27, it says, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord concerning Eli. So I ask the question, what word of the Lord is being fulfilled? What are we talking about? What does this harken back to? Well, I mean, but it says concerning the fulfill the word of the Lord, which was spoken concerning the house of Eli, not the Levites, Eli. So what specifically about Eli? What'd you say? OK, so Eli honored his sons over God. And so Eli was punished because of that. Right? Eli being the priest before Samuel came along. And so this harkens back to 1 Samuel 2:31 through 36, was God's judgment of Eli because he was honoring his sons above God, allowing his sons to do what he did. Flip over to 1 Samuel 2 real quick. So this is where God's talking to and rebuking Eli, or judging him, giving his punishment. He says in verse 31, this is God to Eli. "Behold, the days are coming when I will break your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house. And you will see the distress of my dwelling in spite of all the good that I do for Israel. And an old man will not be in your house forever." This idea of "I will break your the strength and the strength of your father's house." They've been priests serving in the in God's house. He's breaking that. You know, where he's his family. And this is where we're getting to that. He's breaking that kind of line or lineage in being priests. He says, "You will see distress of my dwelling." The New King James, I wrote that, the New King James puts it, "And you will see an enemy in my dwelling place." So that if you read this here, it says, instead of "see you will see the distress," you will see an enemy in my dwelling place in spite of all the good that I do for Israel. So here in this kingship, you will see an enemy. Though Israel is prospering, you will see an enemy here because of what you've done. That's what he's telling Eli. "You no longer be a priest. We're going to break the strength of your house and the prominence of your house and the being servants of serving at the altar. And you're going to see an enemy here in this kingship." And we see this being fulfilled. It's not that he's not going to be an old man. We see some of that there too. But what we do see is this here, that he's made an enemy of the king and that he will no longer be a priest in the house, fulfilling that judgment or that promise to given to Eli for what he had done. Questions, comments on that? It's not Wednesday. Y'all can talk a little more. All right, so continuing on. All right, so we move into 28 through 35. We're just going to keep rolling on. Solomon's going to solidify his kingdom. He's making it his own at the behest of his father. We saw that earlier. Now he's going to deal with Joab. What did Joab hear to cause him distress and flee? That Adonijah was put to death. And it said in verse 28 that although he didn't follow Absalom, Joab had followed Adonijah. All right. What happened to Joab and why? He was put to death. What's the why part of that? Amasa, the commander of the army of Judah at the time that they had divided. He had put those two men to death. And so verse 33 says, "So their blood return on the head of Joab, on the head of his descendants forever. But to David and his descendants and his house and his throne, may there be peace from the Lord forever." If you put two people to death, at your own behest, without David's knowledge, that's what it says. "While my father David did not know." They were two good men, and so this is being returned. This was at David's behest that this happened. That you don't let him grow old or have gray hair going down to Sheol. And so Joab is dealt with. Now, we see this person kind of carrying out these punishments as the agent of Solomon. And I asked, who is Benaniah? Benahiah, something, whatever. He was one of the mighty men. He was a commander. So he was not only a commander, but it said in, I have it written here somewhere. I got it here. It said, I think back in 2 Samuel 8, that he was over the Cherelites and the Pethelites, which is why we have our next question. But yes, he was one of the mighty men. He was over the Cherelites and the Pethelites, and he was the son of Jehoadad. All right, so that's who's carrying it out. He becomes a more prominent person as we see it moving through Saul's reign. And so I've been not necessarily avoiding this question, but it has come up several times in our study. And so I did a little digging, and I'm going to ask y'all. So the Cherethites and the Pethelites are mentioned throughout the story of David, using the following passage and external resources to try to determine who they are to David or who they are in general. And so what did y'all come up with that? They were crooks hired by the Philistines? Okay. That's who they were. Is that who they are with David now? Or the supporters of David?
part of the mighty men referring
to. Okay. Appear to be a part of the mighty men. So this is, I gave some passages to tie some stuff together, and I came across some of what Rocky had said as far as what they were, and now you kind of have them as attached to David. So I don't know that what they were or what they are now from the standpoint of hired mercenaries. Seems like they are loyal to David. What was interesting to me is they seem to be an elite set of warriors. Warriors or mercenaries. And they seem to have been the bodyguards or the protection for David. You see, as he goes out when Absalom usurps the throne, and some other times when Solomon goes to be anointed as king, they're there. That's this kind of elite force. Maybe think of the Navy SEALs or something like that. I saw in some places, going to external references, this is just for our understanding a little bit more about who they are, since they're mentioned so many times, that they may have been mercenaries hired to do such things. Their background, in 1 Samuel 30:16, you see that the people who, I think it was the Egyptians who raided the south of the Cherelite, it says the Negev of the Cherelites, the land of the Philistines. You go down to a couple verses after, that's in 1 Samuel 30. It seems to be that the Cherelites were of Philistine descent. You can see that there. You can see that in Zephaniah 2:5. Ziklag, this is all about the story of when David had left the Philistines, wasn't going to fight with them, and found Ziklag had been plundered, people had been kidnapped. You find it first about the Cherelites there. All right. It seems that they were a part or a subsect maybe of the Philistines, or they were, or of the Philistine lineage. If you look up the name of the Cherelites, there may be that they were originated from Crete, and that those two words, the Cherelites and then Cretians or whatever, over time just the name changed. It's just interesting to me that if they were Philistine, or some say that they were being a subsect, they may have been half Philistine, half Hebrew. It's interesting to me that they were loyal to David, especially with what all David had done against the Philistines. But again, we've seen in time and time again that David had found favor with Achish, one of the Philistine king of Gath. And so it's just interesting, just, you know, to backfill, we talked about the mighty men and everything, the, you know, who these men might be and why they were loyal to David. Providence of God, I would say so, but also because of the qualities and traits that David had, being a loyal, righteous person, honest, upright, you know, good. I mean, you're going to follow somebody who's a good leader, a good strategist, a great warrior, had a lot of courage. And so it's just interesting. It's on the tail end of all this, but it was interesting as it's come up so many times. You know, just giving a little bit more. You not only got these mighty men, these 30-something mighty men that are mentioned, but now you've got this elite group of warriors who follow David too. It gives credence to the idea of 12,000 men coming to take David, or the entire nation of Israel coming to take David. If you've got, you know, think about the Philistines. It's not just, they're not just elite warriors or mercenaries or whatever. You're thinking about their size and their how imposing they would seem when you go up to fight them, as large as they are and as fierce as they are. And so, anyway, it was just, I wanted to catch that on the end of things since we hadn't discussed it before. Yes, sir.
Do you think these are the men that were with David before he was king? Like, you know, Abigail, you know, in the field, how David had his men with him? Because it was kind of my impression that those men weren't, you know, reputable men in the first place. I don't know if you can...
When you're talking about there, I don't know if they were a part of it at that point, but when he started gathering followers is when he left Achish and you know, the Philistines the first time, when he feigned insanity, and then he started picking up men who were, I think at that point, they were those who were destitute or had some criminal history or something like that. I'm not sure if they got picked up at that point, or I think it seems to me it may be after, because Abigail and them were in 1 Samuel 25, and the first time we read of them is 1 Samuel 30, or at least the Cherelites, and then moving into 2 Samuel is where we see it again. So probably not. Those men who picked up with David when he came out of the Philistine region and into Moab, back into Judah, probably the men that you're thinking about, if I've got that right. That's just off the top of my head, but I'll look into it, double check. But I think that they're mentioned later on in the story. But they do, I mean, they do as a part of all this, eventually become these men who travel with David and fight with him. They were the ones who were with him when he left after Absalom usurped the throne and helped him get it back.
Mm-hmm. And so the Lord said, I'll destroy them.
Which is interesting, too, since they were loyal to David here. I mean, there's no indication that I can find, and that's the interesting part of this that we could go way off, is I don't think that David paid them. They went with him. Maybe David did pay them, but it seems to me that all these men that were loyal to David fought for him out of allegiance to him, as opposed to, I mean, getting your regular wage, but, you know, being a paid mercenary just to fight for the money, as opposed to being fighting for the allegiance to the person you're with. All right, I got 10 minutes. I talk fast. I think we can get it. All right, so again, Solomon solidifying his kingdom. What was Shimei instructed to do, and what warning was given? And did he?
No.
3 years. 3 years, but no, essentially, no. If you're told that you're going to be punished or executed if you don't stay in that house, you think that a couple of servants wouldn't be something I'd be too concerned about. I don't think I want to cross over. Well, the Brook Kidron is kind of the boundary line that we're given here, but I think I would just want to stay. Maybe this is the pigheadedness of Shimei, but he goes. We see here again, we see Achish, the king of Gath. He goes to Gath to get his guys back, and maybe this was the providence of God. I mean, you know, David said to not let him go down to Sheol with gray hair. So did Shimei agree and agree to this? And did he heed the warning? Yes, he agreed. No, he didn't heed the warning. So what does Solomon tell him in 44 and 45? Solomon in verse 44 says, "You know all the evil which you acknowledged in your heart, which you did to my father David. Therefore, the Lord shall return evil on your own head." Remember, he cursed him and said, this is for all the bloodshed on Saul's family. And so he's going to curse him. And David let it go. He said, if God wants him to curse me, let him curse me. But in verse 45, it says, "But King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David shall be established before the Lord forever." And kind of putting that period on it, or that exclamation point. This isn't about that. And Solomon will reign. So your need or want to bring back Saul, or to justify what Saul was, a wicked man. And so this is kind of the exclamation point on that. And so he's put to death. And who did it? Benaniah. And we see here that at the end of verse 46, thus the kingdom was established in the hands of Solomon, kind of carrying out the final wishes of David and kind of establishing the kingdom, make it his own. So Solomon rules. Who did Solomon marry and why? Pharaoh's daughter. Why did he marry her?
There was an alliance.
There's an alliance. Be curious to know if this is in the situation where she's his wife by maybe legality versus actual being his wife. I married her, but you know, they never consummated the relationship. It was just this idea of we're going to consolidate houses and consolidate power. Don't know. It's just a conjecture. But it's interesting that it's Pharaoh's daughter because of some stuff that happens later on, and the fact that the ordinances, statutes, and judgments that they were to follow were all because of the stuff that had happened in Egypt as they came out. And you think with Pharaoh's daughter there, that might be a reminder as we get into some other stuff. What does verse 3 say about Solomon?
Loved the Lord and was walking.
Except for burning incense. But the idea here is that he was doing the will of God, following in the footsteps of his father. He was a good and righteous man. Let's see. Now, I put in this next question, what did God ask Solomon? Again, it's one of those where he didn't ask him, he told him something, but he was looking for a response. So what did God tell Solomon a little further down? Ask him, what do you wish? And what does Solomon answer, or respond, saying?
An understanding heart.
Yeah, that's what he's asking for. He said, you've made your servant king in the place of my father David, yet I am but a little child and do not know how to go out or to come in. And so give me an understanding heart to judge your people, to discern between good and evil, for who is able to judge this great people of yours? Solomon here has a pure heart. He He's wanting to be able to be a good king and a good judge of the people. How did God view Solomon's answer, and what did God do for him? It pleased him. It pleased him. And so what did God do for him? More than he asked for. Not only gave him the wisdom that he requested, but it also gave him riches and honor. So he not only gave him a wise and discerning heart, but he gave him riches and honor. And then what did God tell him in verse 14? And that harkens all the way back to Deuteronomy 4 and 5 and all that stuff we spent an entire class studying. Obey the statutes, the commands, the judgments, and they will prosper in the nation. You specifically, Solomon, I will prolong your days. All right, so he gets this wisdom and this discerning heart. And so I put in here, in the story of the two harlots, is Solomon's judgment crafty or is it true wisdom? It's true wisdom. I know for me, as you study this, you read it. We read it so often. Maybe you don't appreciate the wisdom that goes into something like this to understand maybe what Solomon was thinking. How do you make that choice? It seems kind of obvious. Well, we'll cut it in half, and whichever mom gives up the right to him is really the one, because she cares, you know, with that maternal instinct. He obviously is a very wise person. In verse 28, it says, when all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had handed down, they feared the king, for they saw that his wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. This idea that, you know, this one baby died, these women claimed the baby to be theirs, and to have an understanding, I don't know that we would, any of us, you read the story now, maybe you would make that decision, but any of us would understand, okay, how do you decide between this one baby and these two women? I mean, there's a 50-50 chance that this baby goes to the wrong person. And then to make the decision, we're just going to kill the baby. Give them to both, I'm done. And then to understand that the response that you give will elicit an answer that will help you make your decision. I mean, to me, this is the true wisdom of it. Because there's the what ifs. You can what if it to death. What if they didn't respond that way? What if, you know, both of them still wanted the baby and cry? I mean, because he's kind of worked himself into a corner, don't you think? But this is the true wisdom, to know that, it seems to be to know that one of them will be willing to offer the baby up because life for the baby is better than death for the baby if you're really the mom. You know, kind of the idea of I want a better life for the baby, so even if it's going to be over here with this other person, I would like the baby to live versus this other one, just give me half. I'm already sorrowful for the death of a baby. It's just it's true with wisdom, not craftiness. And you see that in verse 28. Man, we did that and I still got 3 minutes to spare. I want to look back for a second at Deuteronomy. Go back to Deuteronomy 6 for a sec. We see in 1 Kings 3:14, it says, if you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and commandments as your father David walked in them, I will prolong your days. And it's interesting to me here, Deuteronomy 6, verse 20. It says here, when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what did the testimonies and the statutes and the judgments mean, which the Lord our God commanded you? Then you shall say to your son, we were slaves to the Pharaoh in Egypt, and the Lord brought us from Egypt with a mighty hand. Moreover, the Lord showed great and distressing signs and wonders before our eyes against Egypt, Pharaoh and all his household. He brought us out from there in order to bring us in, to give us the land which he had sworn to our fathers. So the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, and for our survival as it is today. It will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe all the commandments before the Lord our God, just as he commanded us. This idea that, you know, you're going to say we do this because we were slaves and God brought us out. We do this because of this, and God will, to remember what God has done for us. And that's what he's talking about here. And this is going to be something prevalent as we get into Solomon's later life. Smartest man, the wisest, most discerning heart, is going to have everything. He's got Pharaoh's, you know, an Egyptian in his house. And then, you know, as we see, you know, his heart turns away from God. You can see him 7:4. You know, even these are the wisest man. Wisdom isn't always the greatest thing for you, because maybe you can, you know, see scientists today. They may be smart, but it doesn't mean you're wise. It tells you in Deuteronomy 7:4 they weren't to intermarry. What did Saul do? He intermarried. Go to Deuteronomy 8, and it talks about humility. You know, it talks about God's gracious dealing with the people. Verse 2, it says, "You shall remember that all the ways in which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness for 40 years, and that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. He humbled you and let you be hungry." The idea of humility. That was the purpose of being in the wilderness, and things that they should remember. And he disciplined them, verse 5. We talked about that a second ago. "Thus you are to know in your heart that the Lord your God was disciplining you, just as a man disciplines his son." We need discipline. Then he goes on to talk about what happens if you forget the Lord. And that it says, "Then your heart will become proud and you will forget the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery." Forgetting the God, turning to other gods because you've forgotten the Almighty and what he's done for you. That'll be a key part of this. We see Solomon is doing this now, but keep that in the back of your mind as we continue on. Wisest man lets his heart turn away from God. All right, that's class for this morning. Thank you.